Welcome to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains. I'm Corby Skinner.
And I'm Anna Page. And we're sharing stories of creative people who live and work in the Intermountain West.
Erin Parrott is a Helena-based musician, songwriter, author, professor, and the publisher of Territorial Press. His book, Montana Americana Music, Boot Stomping in the Big Sky Country, is his latest investigation into Montana history and culture.
In 2006, Sarah Calhoun started Red Ants Pants, a company based in White Sulphur Springs that makes workwear for women. She is also the mastermind behind Red Ants Pants Music Festival, held annually also in White Sulphur Springs. The festival benefits Red Ants Pants Foundation, which helps foster strength and self-reliance in women in rural and agricultural communities.
Erin and Sarah are two creative and enterprising Montanans. Both have an ear for music and a heart with a mission. Erin Parrott is a man with many irons in the fire. He started writing songs in 1995 while living in Athens, Georgia, where he was enrolled in graduate school in comparative literature. He recently started writing more than just songs, an academic tome on traveling to the moon, various essays, and dozens of short stories that have appeared in literary journals and magazines. Now he's teaching at the College of Great Falls, playing music gigs throughout the state, still writing, and running Territorial Press in Helena, Montana. Welcome, Erin.
Thank you for having me.
So you just started writing fairly recently, is that true?
Well, probably 20 years ago, I guess. 17 years ago, I published my first short story. My Moon book that you mentioned came out in 2004, I think.
But you had been writing music for a long time.
Sometime in the late 80s, early 90s, I started writing songs. I'd been playing banjo, and then I picked up a guitar and started writing country songs.
So what made you move from music into Travels to the Moon? So the book is an annotated version of Edgar Rice Burroughs.
No, that's a separate project.
Oh, that's a separate book.
So my PhD dissertation was a survey of all the novels written about traveling to the moon. And then that got turned into a book published by Ashgate Press in England. But the annotated Edgar Rice Burroughs is actually just a few years ago, 3 or 4 years ago. And they were putting out a new edition and just asked me to annotate it, which is pretty fun.
So you're still writing songs as well as writing essays and short stories?
Occasionally I write a song, but not like I did. I mean, I was in a band, so, you know, we were kind of
Road guys, yeah.
Yeah. So now I do it just occasionally.
One of the books that I thought was interesting is Literary Butte, A History in Novels and Film. What brought you to that topic?
Well, that's actually a great story. I was born in Butte and spent a lot of time there growing up. And I just was always fascinated by how many novels I would encounter that had to had Butte as the main topic. And so I wrote this essay. It started out as an essay about a few of the novels that I'd read, and I sent it to Alan Jones, and he said, thanks, but no thanks.
We'll have to ask Alan Jones about that.
Oh, he'll tell you. But then a few months later, he said, but I do have this other idea. I think you should write a book about Montana. It was the 150th anniversary of territorial status. So that's how Montana Then and Now came about. But then another editor at another press got wind of the Butte thing and said, hey, do you think you could turn this into a book? And in the end, you know, he had to limit me with how long I could make the book because I left out quite a lot of stuff, but still ended up talking about 37 novels and I think 10 films.
From Dashiell Hammett on.
Right. And, you know, for a town of its size to have that many well-known books written about it, I think is pretty unique. I can't think of another town.
And like it's that. Interesting, people are still writing about Butte.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's probably the city in Montana that has more books than anything else.
Right, it's true. Every year, another few come out. And one of the films I have to mention that I missed, Cherie Newman pointed out that I forgot Psycho Sheep of Butte. That came out in
Were you sleeping or what? You missed that?
Somehow I missed that, but I have to say it is a truly remarkable piece of cinema.
Montana Then and Now. It's been called a romp through the state's history that's both entertaining and intelligent. That's the book that Alan Jones wanted to publish. Is that correct?
Correct. Yeah, he came to me with this idea and said next year is the 150th anniversary of statehood. So naturally, I wanted to use the Latin and call it a sesquicentennial history. But he's like, no. The basic idea was to compare what things were like in 1864 to 2014.
And then how did you divide it in terms of it's not chronological?
No, I just picked various themes. The economic drivers, for example, mining, which sort of started the state versus today, tourism, I think, is the rapidly approaching number one economic driver. Demographics, like what the composition of people looked like in 1864, obviously mostly Indian versus 2014. I think Native American Indians now make up like 7% of the state population.
And I'm sure Butte played a role too in terms of how big and prosperous Butte was at one time.
Well, it did, but in 1864, Butte was not quite started yet. That was a couple of years later. But Helena, for sure, mm-hmm. was a focal point. I think the strike there was 1863-64.
Tell us about Territorial Press.
I'm not sure exactly how to start, but I guess I would say I began rebinding old books, old leather-bound books. And a friend of mine saw me doing it, and he was like, you need to just get a printing press. And then I met Peter Koch, who's a famous Montana personage down in Berkeley, and he has a big printing studio down there. And he kind of encouraged me and helped line me up with a C&P press and some type. And, you know, I started out doing small broadsides and then just sort of developed that into actually printing books.
So explain a little bit the difference between the press that you have and what most people are probably thinking a press is. Yours is all old-fashioned single letter linotype press, right?
Yeah, not even a linotype. It's just one letter at a time. So handset type mostly, although the book we just printed was with polymer plates. It so happens that letterpress printing right now is sort of a merging of two technologies. Essentially, mostly what I do is handset type on a treadle press, so it's foot-powered. essentially, the state-of-the-art technology from 1870.
At one time, I think Helena had like 6 newspapers.
Yeah.
And were those all set on linotype?
I wrote a brief history of early printing in the Montana Territory for the Montana Historical Society magazine. I guess that's 2 years ago now. And some of the photographs in that article I highly recommend because they do show these print shops, you know, where newspapers were put out single letter at a time.
Oh, my gosh.
And, you know, these would be 8-page newspapers set daily. And then they would tear them all apart and redistribute the type and then set the next day's paper.
Tell me about the books that you have done, you've written and printed using letter set type.
So when I was first learning this process, I wanted to make a little book the way they would have done it in the territory in 1860s or 70s, which is all handset type and then printed on sheets, which you would then fold and then sew together and then bind in a book. And the first one I did of those was called Curses. You know, very short little 32-page book. And then I got the idea of actually printing a real book. So it's the one we just finished is about 150 pages, printed 4 pages up at a time. So you have to set type for 4 pages. Although this was printed with polymer plates, so mm-hmm. much much faster.
I think people are surprised at that don't know about handmade books. They're very expensive.
Yeah.
They should be, because really they're more artwork than anything. I mean, it's a one-of-a-kind, unique book.
I agree, and it's hard to differentiate for people who are unaware of, letterpress, what exactly is involved there. But I would compare it to photography. You know, in the middle of the 19th century, when photography was invented, a lot of people were panicking that oil painting was going to disappear. but really what it did was clarify what oil painting was as an art form. And so it's true, you didn't need documentary oil painters to paint battlefields anymore, because right. You could take a picture. I think the same is true of letterpress books. You know, books come in all kinds of forms. And like anyone else, I love a paperback book that you can buy for a dollar at the used bookstore and read and then leave at the airport. But there are other books that are, you know, handmade, well-crafted letterpress books that, you know, are sort of museum pieces, really.
Right. I have a beautiful piece that Peter Koch and Deborah Erling did.
Lost Journals of Sacagawea.
Yes. Yeah. I bought it at an auction, and I thought I got a steal on it, because I don't think people understood what a beautiful piece that was, or understood enough about the process of doing that. But
and you have a print from it, or the
yes,
book itself?
Yes, I have the print from it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an amazing book, and I think, you know, they're like $10,000 a copy.
Right. That I don't have.
Yeah, me either.
So from art books to mass market books, your most recent book is Montana Americana Music, Bootstopping in Big Sky Country. What brought you there? Certainly as a musician, but did you have to do a lot of research about Montana music?
This book came out of an essay that I wrote for the Old Time Herald, which is a journal of old time fiddling. I wrote a long essay about the history of fiddling in Montana, because unlike a lot of the Western states, it started here pretty early. Lewis and Clark had two fiddlers with them. So 1804, you know, the fiddling tradition in Montana started. And an editor at the History Press, who'd read the Literary Butte book, wrote and asked if I could expand that into a bigger book. So that's how the book started.
When you look through the Lewis and Clark journals, it's surprising how often they stop and play music.
I love all those passages where we got out the whiskey and we got out the fiddles.
Yeah, it made it seem like it wasn't all that hard, right?
No, and you know, the two fiddlers, I think, were John Gibson and Pierre Cruzat. And Cruzat is the guy who shot Lewis in the back on the return trip. You know, because he was not only a fiddler, but he was blind in one eye. So
you don't have to see to be a good fiddler?
No, it's all by ear.
So from the early days of Lewis and Clark, where did it evolve in terms of music?
That's an excellent question. And the thesis of the essay was trying to discover whether there's a Montana style of fiddling. In fiddling culture, there's a very distinct West Virginia style, for example, a very distinct Georgia style, North Carolina, Texas fiddling. All these states sort of have a style associated with them, and I was curious whether Montana had such a thing. And it turns out it doesn't, because it's so recently become its own culture, but it draws from all these traditions I just mentioned, you know, Texas fiddling, Missouri fiddlers, West Virginia, but probably one of the most distinct is the Métis. And in fact, Pierre Cruzat, who I just mentioned, he was Métis. I mean, so, you know, people don't realize that a third of the people on the Lewis and Clark expedition were Métis Indians.
Mm-hmm. That book is available online and in bookstores.
Bookstores everywhere.
Bookstores everywhere. So we have a special treat today, because I think for someone that's a musician and has written a book about Montana Americana music, it's only appropriate that we would have a little music in the studio. And you have brought along guest.
My good friend, Russell Rowland.
Russ Rowland, whose book, 56 Counties, came out this last year and has also been a guest on our show. And you're the backup singer. Russ, I forgot that you were a musician at heart.
That's right. Yes, I studied music in college.
So, boys, let's have a song.
All right. I will say this was actually Russell's idea. We were doing a reading together somewhere, and he knew about this book, and he reminded me, hey, I was a music major. I can sing tenor. We should learn a few songs. So we learned some Leuven Brothers songs and have been playing them around the state.
Let her go, let her go, God bless her. She's mine anywhere she may be. She may ramble this wide world all over, but she'll never find a friend like me. I went to church last Sunday, and I saw my old true love there. I could tell that her mind was changing by the way that she'd done up her hair. Let her go, God bless her. She's mine anywhere she may be. She may ramble this wide world all over, but she'll never find a friend like me. Sometimes I live in the country, sometimes I work in the town, and sometimes I take a fool notion to jump in the river and drown. Let her go, God bless her. She's mine anywhere she may be. She may ramble this wide world all over, but she'll never find a friend like me. I'm going downtown to the races, gonna watch my little pony run. And if I win any greenbacks, you know I'm gonna give you some. Let her go, God bless her. She's mine anywhere she may be. She may ramble this wide world all over, but she'll never find a friend like me. She may be. She may ramble this wide world all over, but she'll never find a friend like me.
Nice job, boys. I think if this writing career doesn't pan out, maybe you have a career on the road.
We'll make tens and tens of dollars.
Thank you, Aaron, and thank you, Russell, for coming into the studio.
Thanks for having us.
I'm joined in the studio today by Sarah Calhoun, the founder of Red Ants Pants, a company based in White Sulphur Springs focused on making workwear for women. Thanks for being with us today, Sarah.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so Sarah, you started Red Ants Pants in 2006, a company born out of this long frustration from ill-fitting clothing and workwear that just wasn't really designed for a woman's body or for the fit and function. Mm-hmm. It seems like you have spent a lot of time in workwear. You grew up on a farm in rural Connecticut.
Yes.
What was that life like?
It was fantastic. It was a very small community in northwestern Connecticut. My grandparents had a dairy, and then my folks had a llama farm, actually. So growing up in a place where you can be outside and on the farm all the time and have parents living at home was fantastic. And a really solid community there.
So how did this shape your work ethic and prepare you for this entrepreneurial life that was to come?
I think it was just expected of my sister and I to work hard and And also my grandparents were, they lived next door and had exceptional role models, and that is a good thing to have.
You were inspired to move to Montana, I've read, after you read Ivan Doig's This House of Sky.
Mm-hmm.
So what about his novel really attracted you or captivated you to Montana?
So I actually didn't even read it until I had moved to Bozeman. And then after a year in Bozeman, the town was a little too big for me, I can say, in Bozeman. And that's when I read This House of Sky, and I was looking for a more rural, genuine cow town, and White Sulphur certainly fit the bill there. And what I loved about Doig's writing is that it's raw and real and gritty, and it's not just the beautiful romanticized version of this place. You know, it's there's a lot of grit and wind and sagebrush in there. So
yeah, and he does such an excellent job of balancing the poetic descriptions of this beautiful part of the country with, like you said, that gritty working culture that mm-hmm. Montana was founded upon.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So you knew, I mean, what brought you to Bozeman?
I had an idea of what Montana would be, and I had never been there, but I was saving it. So
nice.
Yep.
So from Bozeman to White Sulphur, mm-hmm. White Sulphur Springs really just seemed like the place for you. It was the right size, and it had that feel that you were looking for, and you knew that that was going to be your home?
Absolutely. Yeah, it felt right. It just, everything came together as it should.
So how did you take a leap into founding this workwear company?
So I had some great mentors along the way, certainly. I had a very chance meeting at a coffee shop right when I moved to Bozeman. And I was reading my How to Start a Small Business for Dummies book, because I didn't even know what a business plan was at that time. And a guy noticed the book, and it turns out he had worked doing the production and design for Patagonia for 20 years. So Richard Cibarel, he's still on my advisory board to this day and just a top mentor. So I just started learning everything I possibly could about production and design and marketing and branding and starting the company website and financing and finding a manufacturer and sourcing the textiles and all of that. I had a lot to learn, because I had no experience in either business or the apparel industry. So because my background was, I studied environmental science and then worked for Outward Bound and Trail Cruise. So I'd spent a lot of time in the backcountry. So I knew what I needed in the product, and I knew there was a demand, and I knew that I had some creative marketing potential. That was about it. And then just hit the ground running. And after about 2 years of learning everything I could, finally got the doors open in the fall of 06 and started selling work pants.
Wow. From not having any business background, no connections in the textiles or any of that, to have this chance meeting, how serendipitous Montana sure does give when you open those doors.
It sure does. It's amazing.
The foundation was formed as a nonprofit branch of this workwear company in support of women's leadership, working family farms and ranchers and rural communities. Where did the idea for the foundation originate?
So this is, it's kind of come full circle with the culture behind the brand of the workwear company and the nonprofit now. Those are the pieces that are really important to me, the women's leadership and the supporting ag culture in rural communities. And I think there's a lot of things to be learned from the ethics in small towns that we can apply just to the broader human landscape. So starting the foundation seemed like an obvious next step, especially when we were getting the music festival off the ground too.
So those two things sort of came hand in hand.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Yep. So the festival is certainly an element of our programming with the foundation, and also one of the main fundraisers to support the foundation.
Yeah, so you're in your seventh year for mm-hmm. the Red Ants Pants Music Festival. It's happening July 27th through 30th, and you've seen more and more attendance every mm-hmm. year. And last year you had a record-setting 16,000 people show up to party in a cow pasture.
Mm-hmm.
I have had the fortune of going to a couple of these festivals, and it's very difficult to describe the feeling there. And I hate to put you on the spot, but what is that uniqueness that is Red Ants Pants?
Mm-hmm. It is tricky to put into words, but there's some form of goodwill, I think, that happens there with the human connection of the people in that beautiful cow pasture. And when you set the scene with the landscape and the sunsets, and the music is such a huge part, obviously, but mm-hmm. it's more than that. It's more than the music, certainly. It's that feeling when you are with your good buddies in a cow pasture and meeting new people and crossing over the bridges of folks from different backgrounds. And one of my favorite stories is the first year, I think, actually, a fan sent a picture in, and It was of two men standing with their backs to the camera, and they didn't seem to know each other well. They were just having a beer and enjoying the show. Mm-hmm. And one guy, the back of his shirt, it read, "Save the Planet." And the other guy, who must have worked for an asphalt company, his shirt said, "Pave the Planet." But there's something really important to me about that connection, you know? And it's gritty. It's definitely, there's dust and it's hot and it's, we do all the dust mitigation and shade structures and try to make it a really enjoyable experience for everyone. But it's very authentic rural Montana, and we do a lot of demonstrations to do a little of the fun parts of whether it's ranch roping or sheep shearing or crosscut saw competitions or that sort of thing to really get those skills through to the folks that don't get to see that on an everyday basis.
Yeah, because the price of admission goes straight back to empowering the foundation mm-hmm. to help support these different types of skills. I know you hold workshops for women to teach them timber skills. Mm-hmm. What other things come from the music festival?
So the timber skills course is a 4-day chainsaw and carpentry training for women in the fall, and that's September 21st through 24th, held in White Sulphur. And we also have a grant cycle, which we are about to announce this spring. We are just determining our proceeds from last year's event are now going to grant recipients this spring across the state with a variety of different projects to support rural communities and different farms and ranches. And it's so exciting. That's just really fun to be able to throw a party and then give money away to worthwhile projects. And we're also working on developing a women's leadership program that is targeted at junior year girls in high school across the state to do kind of an in-depth leadership training year-round. So we're hoping to get a pilot program out next year, 2018.
Oh, that's exciting to give them that opportunity at a very young age mm-hmm. to start to get their sights towards their future goals and potentially stepping into leadership roles as they grow up. Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about the artists coming to this cow pasture. Looks like your headliners, the Bellamy Brothers, mm-hmm. as well as Lucinda Williams. I'm very excited about her.
Yes, absolutely. We've kind of been holding on to that idea of bringing Lucinda in for a while. We've had so many requests and it just worked with her routing and the scheduling this year. So super excited to have her. And then Asleep at the Wheel,
fun
classic old Western band that the White Sulphur community is head over heels excited for that one. And one of my personal favorites, Shooter Jennings, is coming, and he'll play Friday night. And he is playing with his dad, Waylon Jennings, the original band, Waymore's Outlaws, and that's their final tour that they're going to do in their career. So that'll be kind of a neat experience.
Oh, and I see the Turnpike Troubadours are coming back.
Mm-hmm.
Now, remind me, if I'm remembering correctly, that was the show where that wild storm rolled in the middle of their set, and just, there's no escaping the storms out there, and you can see for miles, the vistas are amazing, so you can just watch these weather patterns come in and out,
mm-hmm.
and everybody's just dancing in the rain, it just didn't matter.
Yep, and that was, I think it came right at one of their top hit songs that everyone was so excited for, and the energy in that field was unbelievable that day. Luckily, no lightning, so we didn't have to evacuate, but and it cooled everyone down just enough.
Yeah, what a wonderful piece of the country to get to share with people who maybe don't necessarily get to experience that mm-hmm. rural setting. Mm-hmm. I think the musicians as well are really taken by this beautiful area and the peacefulness that comes with playing there. There's a gentleness to the festival in some ways. Even though it can be rowdy and a ton of fun, there's also a kindness that's shared between everybody there that I've experienced. And mm-hmm. perhaps that's the feeling that we're looking to describe is mm-hmm. that camaraderie and that just real sweet gentleness of the rural nature of Montana.
Mm-hmm. We're all in this together.
Thank you so much, Sarah, for being here, chatting a little bit about your life and what led you into this workwear company and then into empowering other women in the state to start their own companies and just supporting live music in Montana. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains, produced by Anna Page, Corby Skinner, and Ken Siebert for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music by Alex Nauman. Hear this program anytime online at ypradio.org.